Hello everyone, my name is Amandine Flax and welcome to a new episode of Entrepreneurs Playing Games podcast edition. Every 2 weeks I host a live video stream where I deep dive into startup founder's journey after playing video games with my guest. Here is the audio version of our discussion. If you are interested in the full video, be sure to check out and follow my YouTube channel at youtube.com/amandineflax. And for any questions, suggestions, or just to say hi, you can find me on Twitter at amandineflax or at entrepreneurspg. Today, I sit down with Paul and Christian, founders of Hypersafe. You've been watching a few of the videos, so you know that we start by the beginning, talking about your own startup and what Hypersafe is. So can you tell us more about that?
I think I can do that.
Shortest pitch. Okay, so it's a wonderful live interactive presentation platform. The live part means that you get to share your slides with your audience and they join you by using their phones and sharing your code and so on. And the interactive part means that you can augment the slides that you already have by adding live quizzes, gathering feedback from your audience, gathering questions from your audience, and overall increasing significantly your interaction. That's kind of the point of Hypersafe, mm-hmm. and we've launched it 3 years ago. And it's been growing a lot. We enjoyed it very much. Now we are in the hundreds of thousands of users that have been exposed to Hypersafe, and we have a core of 20,000 hardcore users of this platform. Most of them are from the educational space. So initially we were an education technology company, but we kind of grew outside of that, I guess, and now we are being Hypersafe is being used for anything from town hall meetings for mid-sized companies up to Indian weddings. So you can, it's a very wide range of situations in which Hypersafe is being used. Mm-hmm. Even on Sundays in Portugal, there is a preacher that is using Hypersafe.
That's amazing. So, I love
there
that.
There you go.
because everybody uses PowerPoints and slides, and this is how they got to use our platform. Because actually we offered an evolution to that. Mm-hmm. So PowerPoints hadn't been evolving for 20 years almost, mm-hmm. and we offered the next step, which was not a revolution, it was an evolution that is going to become a revolution. So we offered the path from now to tomorrow, and people can take it. It's not a leap of faith like you see in films. That doesn't work in business. You have to offer people a path to evolve.
And it doesn't work in education as well.
Yeah, in education as well.
Small steps, good steps. So that's
Well, that's funny you talk about education, because I'm actually wondering if, before talking about, you know, the evolution and how this happened, I want to keep that for the next part, because I have lots of questions about
okay,
it. But I want to know more about the educational space. Do you feel that it's really a space that is really hard to modernize and there are lots of barriers to entry? Or do you feel that right now it's just evolved and became more like a broader space and things happen outside of the classroom now? And when you talk about being in educational startups, it's like more in a broader sense.
No, initially we really meant it in a narrow sense, as in we were looking specifically at secondary education and higher education. So these were the two areas. And this has been our focus for some time. We've developed digital textbooks, software for digital textbooks to address this market. We were working with publishers, educational publishers. Mm-hmm. We are very education focused and this formal type of education, right? Mm-hmm. Your question was a bit wider than that. You said that...
Is it really hard to get into the educational space?
Is it a citadel where we can have to do some attacking with ladders that go up and they put hot water on top of our heads? Or is it something like a more welcoming, village?
No, it's not very welcoming. It's really hard to get into the educational space. But I don't think that this is exclusively, let's say, education's fault. Education is first; it's not one thing. Mm-hmm. It's made of many, many small pieces. But I think there is, and there has been for quite some time, a bit of a disconnect between the eagerness of companies, including ourselves, to push technology, new ways of teaching or whatever, mm-hmm. and their reluctance to mm-hmm. adopt these, because some of them are not that great as they they tell that they sell their own story to be, or they're not that effective, or they are disconnected with the way teachers are teaching today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's all about, it's a sort of a mismatch, and you sometimes hear that when you listen to, for instance, you listen for a department, a head of department that says, "Oh, I'm meeting 10 startups a week, and I cannot buy anything from there, either too expensive, or too far away, or too unconnected to our existing systems." So it's two
yeah.
worlds which do not really get along that well.
Yeah,
but
we,
this has
yeah,
been changing.
We feel that people in the education space are sometimes victims, and they have trauma from the back.
Yeah, yeah.
they are always attacked by people who try to find problems for their solutions. I mean, the software developers and entrepreneurs get to like an idea, they develop it, and they search for problems that they can use their solution for. It's not the other way around.
We should be.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you should face a problem, think about how to solve it. Instead of, oh, we had this great idea.
Mm.
We implemented the software solution. Hey, school, do you want to use this? Because you might have this problem. No, we actually don't. No, you have. And this is what happens, and this is what traumatizes, really. Purchasers and teachers and principals, and when they see somebody else, they say no.
Yes.
So yeah, the first answer is no, and after that we have to convince them, if I use the same metaphor, to lower the gates to let us in, basically. So in their citadel. Yeah.
There are so many interesting stories in this world of education in the UK as well. So for instance, when the world opened up to the idea of learning management systems, which was quite a kind of, sort of a decade ago,
mm-hmm.
There was a governmental program that said, here, all schools in the UK, you have this money, this budget, you need to spend it over the summer, buy learning management systems for yourself.
Okay.
Which sounds like a great idea, but if you have no idea what a learning management system is, how do you choose in exactly 3 months something that is supposed to change the history of your entire school from now on? So.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to very bad choices, that
mm-hmm.
that led to a very a rush from all companies trying to come up with new learning management systems. So some schools were stuck with that because of that they hated technology.
Mm-hmm.
Because so it's a sort of a tumbling
yeah.
down. And there's also a second pathology, I think, that also happens, which is very, I think it is very specific to education. Sometimes there's a professor turned entrepreneur, which sounds like a great idea, but in most cases is not, because it is that teacher or professor, whatever, that finds something that works with their own students,
mm-hmm.
and they think that is a universal solution. So it's a software or a combination of technologies that works very well with his or her style of teaching, with that kind of students, that level of students, and they think they have a business. And because of that, they start building something complex, and then it doesn't work on a larger scale. So it's a very interesting space, to be honest. We're glad we're out of it.
You know, yeah.
Sorry.
Fine, at least it is said.
yeah, it's a...
Okay, that's great to know. And also, so you mentioned that you started you actually have been actively accepting users and having users for about 3 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So how many people are in the team now? You mentioned that you have hundreds of thousands of users, so that's a lot. So I guess you may have already a team. Also, have you get any external funding, or you may be fundraising, or have you bootstrapped everything? Can you tell me a bit more about the organization of the company itself?
I'm about to say all of those that you said.
So
we were bootstrapped, and we've been generating revenues from a different side of our business, which is the textbook creation business. So this has been... Hyperstay has been self-funded for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
We've also raised some money, so we raised a total of 250,000, I guess,
mm-hmm.
for the entire duration of our for the life of our startup so far,
mm-hmm.
which is not much. We also did not need more than that.
Mm-hmm.
We will need now, so very soon we are willing to. We'll open a new round of,
mm-hmm.
depending on current revenues, it's going to be between $500,000 and $1 million pounds. And this one is going to be specifically for Hyperstay, so when to boost this side of our business. And the team is now seven.
Okay.
We're seven right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've been, this is a number that we've been keeping for some time, but this cannot go like that anymore, so we do need new people in.
Okay.
So this is why we're raising, because we want to hire, and we need to do a much better job at things like marketing, so and proper sales. So now we're, it's been, so far it's been okay, this is something very nice that we built, this is the latest incarnation of our ideas, right? But this one is going up very nicely, so let's help it grow even faster. So that's it.
One question we have from Miruna asking, what do you guys think of gamification in education?
Great idea, let's do it.
No, it's tricky. I mean, it looks very much like the game we've just played. It seems easy in the beginning, but you die fast if you don't do it, right? So at some point about 5 or 6 years ago, I think that this was the hype. Everything was gamified, from fitness applications to enterprise resource software. I mean, people got experience points for filling in a form or issuing an invoice. And like anything, it needs to be done right. We still haven't found the best way to do gamifications without being in the way of our goals. Like, gamification needs to help, not to be there just because you can do it. And we do have some gamified experiences, but it's more little things. Such as small animation when people clap to your presentations, and I don't know, pounding hearts, and stars that light when you click them. So it's small, like small surprises that we prepared for our users in the platform. But we decided not to go the full length with experience point medals, because we had, while working in a corporation, we had this saying, like, you are what you measure. And people measure different, so being a universal platform, people use it for different things. And if we wanted to reward claps, like likes in presentations, people will just click on that without looking at the actual content of the presentation. If we gave them experience points for participating to many sessions, they would just join session and leave. So people are very good at tricking systems. So we want to create the system that uses gamifications, gamification when we have to. It's not just for the sake of it.
Two things to say on gamification, I guess. One is that there is a success story by Kahoot.
Yeah.
It's one of the most successful softwares used primarily in education, but also beyond that. They do a brilliant job at gamifying life quizzes or something like that. So with leaderboard and so on. So they're really, really good and really loved, and for the good reasons. But there's also interesting that by watching what they did and how they succeeded and how that how the Kahoot life quizzes are being used, you understand that there is, it's very difficult to use something like that all the time. So it's excellent if you use it in a specific measure, like use it once a session or once every couple of sessions, because otherwise after a certain amount of gamified anything, you cannot we cannot separate anymore between what's gamified and what's distracting.
Yeah.
So there's a fine line that is very hard to walk between these two.
Kahoot is usually used as the best example of how to use gamification.
Probably is, because properly it's really, really.
I'm not sure though if it's not just an illusion of that. I'm not sure if presenters and event organizers really measure the outcome in terms of people comprehension and involvement beyond that game. So judging by my own experience, whenever I see Kahoot, so I managed to win a 4K TV in a Kahoot competition.
That's nice.
Yes. So thank you Kahoot for offering that platform too. But the thing is that it changes my mood from being being concentrated and focused on the presentation to being focused to win. I have an adrenaline rush, and I want to be there the first, and I don't care. I just change my mood, and it takes me about 20 minutes, half an hour to come back to what they want to say. So the thing is that what Kahoot does for me, and probably there are others as well, it changes the mood from going there to get educated on to receive information to going there to win.
Yeah.
And it's the fight versus flight versus being careful, paying attention. And what happens to me is that I want to find there.
Well, one last thing about gamification, for me at least, mm-hmm. about gamification, is when we designed and we keep designing Hyperstay, it's always a very difficult thing to find the balance between novelty, something new and
mm-hmm.
cool and interesting that a presenter is supposed to use with your participants,
mm-hmm.
students, or whoever they are, and get out of the way of the actual teaching. So there is a fine line between these things. It's very hard to walk because
mm.
it's the matter of the interface and the matter of the colors and the matter of the size of the slide, which is the primary way of using the software. And then how do you handle quizzes? How do you have a leaderboard or not? Why? And so there's thousands of questions around this because of this line that we are really consciously trying to walk, which is a balance between these two. So.
Yeah.
And I think this is, I personally find to be extremely difficult
mm-hmm.
about what we're doing, the fine tuning of it.
Lumjack is actually asking if the startup is based on technologies or software. I think it would be good just to make sure everyone knows what we're talking about now that we're done with the gaming part.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
just to remind really quickly what Hyperstay is about.
My turn.
Your turn.
Okay, so Hyperstay is a software as a service for those of you who want to know about it like that. So it is a website, a platform where people can go and create their own live presentations, starting with what they already have, as in slides, Google Slides or PowerPoints.
PDF.
Or PDF, yes. Google Slides, PowerPoints, PDF. You can use whatever you have to start with a presentation. What we offer is a new layer on top of that presentation that makes it interactive and collaborative. It means that instead of just watching somebody present as a member of the audience, you're able to talk back because you have your presentation on your mobile device or laptop or whatever has a browser. So it requires no software installation. So it allows presenters to close the loop. So instead of being a broadcasting is a conversation
mm-hmm.
and also allows presenters to get inside of the participants' heads about did they understand or not? Did they want to say anything or not? So we have lots of interactive
features.
Yes, I was thinking about quizzes and interactive images and videos and so on. So we offer an evolution of the current slide solution to make them web compatible, and we brought them to today.
And I guess that what separates us from part of our competition, and I would name Slido, I think is the largest competition that we have. They were the ones that actually opened up this market for anything live. But the way our approach was a bit different. It wasn't just ditch the slides and use something interactive. Instead, it or collect the questions or whatever
yeah.
how they started. It was for us. It was use whatever you already have, which is your slides, and attach to that or in between your slides those bits that you want to be interactive. Because of there are so many teaching styles and presenting styles. Some use interactive parts only at the beginning. So let's say that you want to teach about the cell, right? And you don't know your students exactly what do they know
mm-hmm.
about the cell. So it's worth spending a couple of minutes asking things
yes.
and collecting the answers, not by raising the hand because
everyone
this
does
is
that
yeah.
at every conference, and it's a bit limited what you can get out of that.
Exactly, because it's going to be people like me that talk a lot. They will go like yeah. But then you have introverted people that they will not be willing to just expose themselves there.
Yeah.
Or you have international students that English is not their first language, such as our case.
Well,
so there are many reasons for which somebody in the audience would not be quite willing to participate
yes.
the traditional way. So we offer a new way through technology, through your own phone, kind of a safe way, let's say, in which you can participate on the same level playing
yeah.
field as
yes.
the rest of your...
We have teachers saying, like, I did not know that student is so smart, that specific student is so smart. He was never talking,
yeah.
he was never expressing his idea, but when they got power of writing, basically.
Yeah,
exactly. Real-time writing, they shine. About what Paul mentioned earlier, competition versus us. Our competition seems to think that a presenter is a DJ, where they have multiple sources that they have to mix. So now we have presentations and we have live
I'll switch to that.
So they have to mix and do the scratch work, I don't know, like DJ. Like, when you're presenting, you need to be focused on what you have to deliver. And one system is enough. You don't have to have multiple systems. So this is why we offer them one system where they have slides and quizzes and interactive parts at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all in one, yeah. One package. Yeah. So that's the idea.
We have actually an interesting question from Lam Jack. So first, well, you asked two questions. How many people currently work in the startup? So you mentioned seven already.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the other question is, how should we know if our startup idea already exists or not? And I think it kind of brings us to the question also of competition. You mentioned Slido, and this is a big competitor. And I think something that you're doing to kind of differentiate yourself is, well, the features, but also there is also the question of getting the business model right. It is a great way of differentiating yourself. And I understand you are working on something also at the moment, so maybe we can address all of this at the same time, like checking if something exists and getting the business model.
It's a very, very famous, almost cliche story about two shoe salesmen that got on an island where nobody had any shoes, so they did not discover the privilege of shoes. And one writes back, like, nothing to do here, nobody has shoes. And the other one, the optimistic one, and the realistic one, I find, is like, so much business opportunities here, nobody has shoes. And so if you see that there is nobody in your space as an entrepreneur, it might be a red flag.
Yeah, a big one.
If nobody creates, headphones for cats, it might be a reason. It might not. I mean, it can be a huge opportunity. You never know. So first is research a bit with using common sense and maybe some friends and family if your idea is right or not. If there is somebody else on the space, they might not be right, correct. Because in our space, there was already a competition. And in terms of competition, we don't think about competitors as being the other companies, but also the status quo. I mean, for us, competition for Hyperse is also marker and whiteboard, PowerPoint itself, unevolved, primitive PowerPoint, let's call it. And and we think, how can we improve? And we think about which features are important, such as, for example, for people that cannot hear in the back, should we add something like subtitles? Yes. For people that do not understand, are not native, or don't have language skills of the present, like the presenter, is it useful to have a translation, live translation? Yes. And we added that as well. So we look at what the situation is, what the competitors do, and we do it better. So.
But his question was more, I suppose it's a him, I don't know, Lam Jacker.
Yeah. Okay.
It was... how should we know if our startup idea already exists or not? Well, this is Google, basically. So you just Google. Or if you are quite clear about what your idea is, you just find a potential user of your idea and ask them whether they've been using something like that or not.
Yeah.
And now, depending on how you ask the questions, you might find things like this is a good idea or a bad idea, but don't really trust users that just tell you it's a good idea. So this is something that we've been to our second accelerator, which was in Netherlands last year, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No, 2 years ago, 2018. And that was, there was one thing that we learned there, which is about validation. Because actually what you're asking there, if you put it in startup terms, it means how do you validate your idea? How do you know it's a good idea? How do you know it's going to work? A, you'll never know if it's going to work unless you build it. But before you build it and you are in the what's called a validation stage, is that you should just go around and ask people first about what they are doing today instead of your... So without your brilliant next idea that will revolutionize everything, you have to ask them how they are doing things now. In our case, And we actually did that, by the way. So when we, before we started Hyperslate, we had the idea. I mean, we really wanted to take slides and make them interactive. That was the point. But before we actually set up to do that, we went about and we asked about 10 lecturers at UCL. We asked to have an interview with them, like half an hour interview, which is called a problem interview. And we asked them things about how do they prepare today for a lecture? How do they, what kind of technology do they use? What do they find frustrating about it? And then you learn a lot of stuff. Some of it has nothing to do directly with your solution. So they may have problems that you're not addressing with your solution, but you, at least you understand their world. And this, this helps enormously with the way you talk about your software from now on, the way you position it, what clearly identifying what problems do you solve, and only later you come and ask maybe the same people, maybe others, about whether your solution is a good fit to that. But first of all, it's about a problem. I mean, there is the graveyard of startups is filled with startups that died because they created a solution for a problem that did not exist. And this is the main pain. Oh, we had we met a guy. Okay, this is fun. Okay. So 5 years ago, we got to London, right? And we went through an accelerator. This is how we got here.
Yeah.
Accelerator called Emerge Education, right? And there, at the Emerge Education, we were quickly confronted with lots and lots of people that we had to pitch every single day, right? Which is fun and exhausting at the same
time. It's a good exercise, but
But we met one guy who was... he was British, I guess.
Yeah, very, very
but
British.
He was... he looked like he's been through thousands of storms. So he was tough, and he was very... I don't know, scarred, let's say, but not but from a startup point of view. So he's been through so many things. He was, he had a startup that failed, and then he built another one, and that also transformed into something else. And he was a developer himself also, right? Because we tend in our company, kind of all of us are more or less developers, right? He's the real one, and I'm not. But so we talked to this guy, and we were like enthusiastic and telling him, oh, we've built a solution like that and it works like this. And he listened to us very, you know, in a, with a wise man posture, something like that. And he said, stop. He said, okay, A, it's obvious that you know your technology. B, it's also obvious that you've built something which works and is nice. And I mean, solution is good. He said, stop writing any line of code and go and find one person that would actually want to use this. By which he did not mean that he thinks that there's nobody using that. That's not, that was not his point. But the way he formulated this was such a shock for us as founders of a startup. It was, I mean, a literal shock. As in, we got out of that meeting, and for about half an hour, we went into a McDonald's, whatever. We could not speak to each other. It was that level of a shock.
Yeah, because we could not speak because you were not speaking, but...
We could not speak because I was... Okay.
Yeah, in order for a conversation to happen, we need one that speaks, both of us.
Okay, but you did not engage in a monologue either, so it was...
No.
It was such a super powerful way of putting... Which is now... It sounds obvious, right? But it's not. It's not...
So it's
you're
not
doing
obvious.
Your thing.
Exactly.
It's really hard to take a step back. And that's why mentors are so useful in this space.
Yeah.
No, so people, engineers, software engineers especially, get excited about blinks and in software. And I see a technology and I see, oh, this is so amazing. I want to play with it.
Yes.
I want to play, but also do something, and so I create a solution for a problem that does not exist. And to come back to the question, if you think that whatever you think you are going to build is what is going to end, you end up with, I mean, you're wrong. So we came to London 5 years ago thinking that we are going to revolutionize how publishers publish textbooks. By speaking to them and to their users, we realized that publishers are not going to release the content that we need because they don't want to cannibalize, to destroy their existing print business model that makes them a lot of money. And second, because they are large companies, very slow companies. But we did talk to their end users and we realized that while not anybody uses textbook, everybody uses PowerPoints and by
common denominator.
Yeah, so we had an idea. We are going to change how textbooks look like, and we ended up with Hyperslate PowerPoint interactive presentations. There is a link in between them, but it was for sure not obvious in the beginning. Not at all. So if you now have an idea about, oh, I want to build this, pursue it, but it's most probably, it's almost for certain that it will not look like the way you think it will look now. So.
And by changing your core idea and what you're building, that means that you also change the target audience.
Yeah.
How did you approach that? Because
actually we don't feel like we changed our core idea.
But we did, it's true. I mean, we don't feel it, but we did. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Previously, I mean, building textbooks required content coming, because we're not a content company, we're a tech company, required content coming from elsewhere, which were the publishers, which meant that our customers were publishers, but our users were teachers. And the way we developed everything about this engine for textbooks previously, so before Hypersay, we looked at the needs of their end users, which were the teachers, right? Mm-hmm. But we had to deal with publishers. So technically, we were a B2B business, right? I say technically because, in fact, we cared so much about their users that we are going to their users to see how our software is performing over their content, right?
Yeah,
we had this had this triangle that we were going on.
We were calling it B2B for C, basically.
But because everything that we were doing was for the teachers and for the students, then we increasingly became a bit incompatible with publishers in a way. I mean, because we had our own ideas about how the content should be structured and so on. Okay, and this in time kind of drew a divide between us and the publishers. So when we built Hypersay, it was also a way to have a revenge on the publishers, because when they were so slow, they were really, really slow in signing anything. So you're doing a trial and you're doing a pilot and evaluate the pilot. And the pilot comes back having excellent results and yet you sign nothing.
Yes.
Yeah,
like, see you in 6 months, right? That's that's really bad. So one thing for any new founder out there, trials are great. Associating your name with big brands because they trial your software is great. But much better than that is a small brand or a person that actually uses and loves your product. That is way more important than wasting some time on some big trials that lead nowhere. So this is, for us, this was a very hard thing to navigate, because obviously, well, coming from Romania to London, of course, you're attracted to all these big brands, big publishers. Yeah, you do trials with everybody. No, it's a waste of time. It's a massive waste of time. So, and we wasted a couple of years, actually, I think, with this kind of idea until we got let's ditch publishers altogether, almost. Mm-hmm. I mean, we still have good relationships with at least two publishers, and we do develop textbooks for them, but they are one in a million. So it's very hard to find something like that. That's not scalable, right?
Mm.
And this is why we've been Hypersay. Hypersay is a B2C now, so you're right. We changed the addressable market, and things are very different, and we do enjoy the B2C model.
Yeah.
Also, because it becomes sort of a B2C to B, because we see customers that love what we are doing, and then they talk to their bosses or to their colleagues or to whoever else is in the company or in the university. So more and more of them adopt what we are doing. Mm-hmm. So this is why it's a sort of B2C to B.
I love that. I love how you're always trying to, you know, it's kind of, you wanted to do it, and by validating your idea, it's not about saying you're B2B or you're B2C, or it's not about what you're supposed to put your company in a box, but actually you really care about what the end user, and that's what drives the rest of the discussion. I think you also mentioned on the phone the other day that you were looking at the different exploring other business models, and I guess in this space it's also something that helps differentiate yourself and position yourself, right? Having this business model right.
Yeah. So it's a bit like this, right? So at the stage that we are at right now, means that we are growing at a certain rate, which we like and we enjoy, and we make a little bit of money out of the pricing model that we currently have. But because of many factors, such as partly the competition, but partly how the setup is right now, it's not like we're gonna become ultra successful based on this pricing model. So from a money perspective, this is not going to go very, very far, right? So our quest has been also to see, now that we succeeded through technology to get people together and to connect their phones with the presentation, right? So in a shared space, what else can you do with this space? Mm-hmm. So that was, in a way, this was the revelation. So we've built enough reasons and we see there is actual demand. So there is a product market fit in terms of the problems that our software is solving. And okay, fine. So we succeeded that. That's a ticket. That's a box that we ticked. We got people together. They like to join a presenter session. They like to share the slide. They like to participate. Fine. What's next? That's the in a way the question. Mm-hmm. And if you go horizontally, next means new features, new types of quizzes, new types of whatever. And yeah, we're gonna do that to a certain degree. I mean, we're always careful with what we're adding into our software for specific product management reasons. But we're also looking in a sort of a vertical, let's say, what else can we do with this? So is there maybe a way in which it's not just presenters paying us to use Hypersay, mm-hmm. how about we pay presenters for the benefit of sponsors? What if, so our intention is actually to settle mm-hmm. ourselves as a marketplace in between sponsors and events. And this would work for, obviously, for large events, but they already know how to get their own sponsors, yes. so that wouldn't be a big thing necessarily. Mm-hmm. But we also, and there we can only supply technology, not the opportunity, right? But for smaller events, for mid and smaller events, we will provide also the opportunity, not just the technology. So this is what we intend to build. Obviously, like I explained before to the viewer, we are now in the validation stage. So we ask people, we try to understand how the advertising world actually works. We're also interested in understanding how CSR works, mm-hmm. and PR and HR, especially with larger corporations. How do they decide on what to spend where and what do they want to get in return? The cool part of all of this is this is not going to be traditional advertising, mm. Because that is already done. I mean, if yeah. you go to a large event, you have the sponsor there normally on a banner, on a physical banner printed somewhere where nobody looks, right? So that happens already and it seems to be fine because sponsors are still alive and events as well. So we are not going to do that, but we're going to use the technology to do things which make more sense for us, which is, for instance, I mean, you are, let's say that you, I don't know, you're IBM and you sponsor mm-hmm. an event, but you would like to know, maybe it's an event about a blockchain, and you would like to know what do they actually think about Hyperledger, their own version yes. of blockchain, versus other blockchains. Or maybe not even that. Maybe you ask them about products built on that, which product they have actually used. So there's a bit of a tool channel that we want to build, powered by advertising, but it's a tool channel between sponsors and participants through a presenter's presentation. So this is the channel that we want to build.
Basically, we look at where how we can bring value while keeping the idea. So because when I said that we did not change, actually I meant we kept our idea of helping people deliver better presentations and great time while in presentation. Because if you think about your last experiences attending a presentation, usually it's the attributes are boring, too long, not exciting, and we want to fight that. And whatever we do in terms of business model will be in line with this and helping that. Mm. So whatever we want to do is to help presenters deliver better presentations and to help the audiences spend their time more meaningfully. Mm-hmm. And whatever we do will be in line with this.
It's amazing that how many little things don't go well in an event. Just a couple of them. One of them is sometimes a technical reason. You stay in the back, you don't hear very well what they are saying. It was a technical mm-hmm. glitch. They didn't have the speakers working very well. This destroys for you the presentation. Definitely. Second, you liked the presentation, but you don't have the slides and you would like to reflect on them later. Mm-hmm. Yep. You don't have them. You get always promised that you will get them. You don't. Mm-hmm. Never do. Yeah. Okay, so two things. Third, sometimes it's the language. Maybe it's not your primary language and you miss a couple of things. Or fourth, it could be something like you got distracted for a second and there was an important idea. There's no way to go back to that and see that. So there are many little things that mm-hmm. that end up collaborating to destroy your presentation, either from a presenter's perspective or a participant's perspective. In most cases, it's participants' perspective. And overall, so on top of this all, you don't even know. I mean, you think you know that it went well or it didn't go well,
mm-hmm.
but properly you don't know. Were they engaged? Mm-hmm. Did they pay attention? Maybe they would have wanted to ask more questions. I will never know because some of them are shy. They will not come to me afterwards and ask things. So we want to address, our technology is built to address these little things
mm-hmm.
that may make your presentation go wrong.
Yeah.
Of course, if you are a world famous presenter, you will not need probably this kind of technologies. Maybe because you are very seductive, you're there in front of the people, be charisma,
mm-hmm.
and you talk about your stuff. So we don't expect that we would really love to Ken Robinson to use Hypersay one day, right, to get into, because he's really, really good speaker. But 99% of the speakers are not that brilliant speakers, right? So you need to engage your audience in a different kind of way,
mm-hmm.
and you can get closer to Ken Robinson.
You know, I know about my limitation. Sorry, Ken, but I can be better than you. but still, I want to know how it worked. I wanted to allow people to address questions. I wanted to see what was the best moment for them. So. Because we moved PowerPoint to the cloud, we also get data about how
mm-hmm.
how the experience went. Because before it was isolated, now it's connected. So as a presenter, I can see what happens. I can have some analytics. I can analyze and reflect on the results. So
yeah.
I think even Ken Robinson can use it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
We had a question there from our.
Yes, there
it's
are
another degree. That's interesting.
Exactly.
Well,
I wanted to actually ask you also about your
please.
Own background at the same time, and also answer Lem Jacker questions on do you need a degree to start your own business and to build such a project?
We do not know. Probably not. I mean, so our background is quite odd because we were born in a totalitarian regime somewhere at the other end of Europe.
In space, no.
In space, no. I mean, no. Maybe it's not far geographically, but from all the other criteria, thinking about all the other criteria, it's quite far.
It's Latin. I mean, it's fine.
So we were born in a society who did not know what private enterprise was. Where actually any kind of enterprise, personal or business, was discouraged, where people were encouraged to be the same. For us, it was swimming against the current. Basically, we had to overcome all of our programming, inside programming, to do whatever we did.
You can tell who the CTO is.
Yeah.
Inside programming.
And this is one reason that because of our different background from probably people from Western Europe or Asia or India, it's everybody has its own his own or her own journey. So it's hard to tell if a degree is required or not. There was no degree for us because there is no entrepreneurship university in Romania where we were born. But we had our frustrations and we wanted to solve them. So we scratched our own itches and this is how everything was born. I mean, we were unhappy with our textbooks. So we tried to build better textbooks.
Mm.
And from that, we were frustrated with what happened with the solution that we came up with. So we built a better one and a better one and a better one. And we are now at this fourth or fifth iteration already. Mm. Okay, but about backgrounds. We have complementary backgrounds, we happen to meet in the middle.
What's your background?
I was thinking about how to better explain this. So in my first year of computer science university, I was going back home, and I was thinking, everything is this world is built by engineers. I am in a train built by engineer, on a track built by engineers, and outside I see an antenna, which was built by engineers. And you know, those people, those buildings that I see are architects and engineers. So everything is built by us.
Yeah, why should Paul exist, right?
Yeah, why do all those people with humanities work? Why, I mean, those people should not exist. Unfortunately, there were other people with more power that thought about this without realizing that it was wrong. So they did more damage than I did. There was no damage for me. So it took me about 8 years to realize that actually I was using the train built by engineer to go visit my parents and friends. I was using my phone to call my loved ones. I was using the heater to get warm, so everything, and I was using the Kindle to read poetry. So everything actually that engineers did it for humanity's reasons, let's say. So this was my journey from being completely ignorant technical person to being more open. So this is how I'm, even if I have a deeply technical computer science engineering background, I really love the other areas outside this, and this is well, Paul is complimentary. So
yeah, my background is, as you've already heard, is humanities. So I actually studied philosophy at university, bam bam, and which I actually really enjoyed. But since quite an early age, the virus of technology was kind of already in me, and I think this came because my mom had a brilliant idea. I think she read somewhere, or I don't know, that the computers are the future. So now we're talking about the early 90s,
yeah.
I guess, right? Mm-hmm. So back then, it wasn't even clear what a computer was. She hadn't seen one. But because she heard about this kind of stuff, she found somebody in Brasov, in my home city, one guy, Gitze, his name, that was teaching privately kids about technology. No, about computers, right? Mm-hmm. Learned computers. So I suddenly found myself among a group of kids that went to this guy's home, and we were explained the basic concepts, and we were taught what later proved to be a bit of programming for kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we were using a Sinclair ZX Spectrum, which is a very beautiful, brilliant,
iconic
computer. So that was the virus that I got in. So I kind of navigated these two worlds quite separately, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I was interested in computers, and this led in time. This led to my grandma selling a piece of land, actually, and with that money she bought my first actual computer, own computer, right? And then another scene is with my parents terrified at me, and we were all around the table in which I was actually taking apart my entire computer. Under the pretext of cleaning the dust from it, but actually I was just interested in it, and they were scared. I mean, so I was removing the CPU, and they were like, oh my god. Then when I put it back together and it worked, it was like everybody was relieved.
Yes.
So these things kind of took me in life in a parallel track, and on the other side I was really interested in philosophy and literature and so on. So this is what I went and I formally studied.
Mm-hmm.
But all my jobs have always been related to technology until I found the MacBook, and this was the thing that really, really diverted me, because Mirna, my girlfriend, she came home with a MacBook, that white, beautiful MacBook, if
mm-hmm.
you remember, the plasticky one, and she said, oh, this is wonderful. I was, of course, in the world of Windows and Linux, and I couldn't care less about Macs, awful, or whatever, and then she asked me something very simple, which was, please help me install Yahoo Messenger, but back then it was a big thing, which I thought I knew. I was a systems administrator, right? My job was systems administrator. I was handling servers, and I was setting up email servers, and
yes.
I was working in a domain, and, you know, serious stuff. So I obviously knew how to install a Yahoo Messenger, and I found it for Mac and downloaded it, and I installed it. I tracked it somewhere. I studied it from the very DMG, never
mm-hmm.
mind. Second day, it wasn't there. So obviously, I have somehow failed at installing it in a very unknown way. And then I ended up kind of researching how do you install a thing on a Mac. And I came up with a form that said, oh, you must be a noob. Okay. And it's very easy. You just drag and drop it. And that's it. What? No. Yes. Of course. Confirmation. Where do you want to?
Mm-hmm.
I was that provided me a shock. As you can see by now, I apparently operate in shocks, in periodic shocks, okay? So that was an actual shock because I thought, how is it possible that me, right? Me. Mm-hmm. And I, how do I not know how to install something? A, and B, how is it possible that there are some systems in this world in which installing a thing is as simple and as natural as drag and dropping something in a folder? What is this madness?
So the irony is that it was so easy that you could not do it?
Exactly. The irony was because I had
so
to
easy
unlearn...
and intuitive that you did not.
Yes, because I had to unlearn bad things that I learned through that. So for me, it was like, how did this happen? What is this parallel universe in which things are happening this way? And this led me to research, to understand about how Apple and build their products. Mm-hmm. This led me to Steve Jobs and understanding here. And I think through that, I kind of had the idea, oh, but wait, so humanities and computers can actually kind of collaborate. Mm-hmm. So, what is this thing called entrepreneurship? So, you know, things kind of came together because of that bloody...
I don't think that you said, I want to be an entrepreneur, therefore I do this.
No, but
I have this problem, therefore I want to solve it, therefore I have to be an entrepreneur.
No, it wasn't like... It was like, I wanted to know why in the history of computers... things can get so far apart. And the answer was not technology. It wasn't the smartness of the people that decided to let's install it like this. Or it was a cultural thing. It was a different view and vision on how things should work. And who is the one that does something like that? Who is the person that puts a vision into place? And what is that, by the way? And this is how I got to the, well, personality of Steve Jobs and so on. So it got me to think, that's something here, right? It's something beyond actual just technology, right? It's about a purpose. It's not about the technology.
What's my purpose?
I met him and then what's my things purpose? Kind of...
Yeah, what did you meet? Because you have very different personalities and background.
You hired me, I hired you.
So we worked for each other for a while and then we worked together. But to answer the questions, if you do need a degree to be an entrepreneur, I don't think so.
Not at all.
Unless
it's from MIT.
Yeah.
If it's from MIT or Berkeley, then yes. But otherwise,
don't bother. It's useful. Come on. So no, my experience, at least if you want to be an entrepreneur and a computer programmer at the same time, a software developer, university is useful or any kind of formal studies. We've been working with many people in our almost 10 years or 12 years. Entrepreneurial careers, and I can tell you that there is a difference in between how people that have formal degrees approach a software problem compared to the others. I mean, both of them are enthusiastic and good, but it is useful to have some sort of formal degree if you want to be a software developer.
Yeah.
If you want to do entrepreneurship, I mean...
This is what he asked. He asked, do you need a degree to build a successful startup? No.
But
I
think
the
that
famous
I,
dropouts, the famous
yes.
dropouts.
Yes. Formal degree, no. Learning, yes. Getting inspired from others, for me, it was essential. I mean, I still read books, I still read articles, and I will always do. So I'll always keep learning. It's not about technology. So I don't think that I will have another degree ever. But the amount of things that I learn every day is similar to what I learned during my university. So never stop learning.
Technology is evolving all the time, so there are lots of things you can't really learn yet at the university, but still you need to learn right now just to be able to build it.
So as long as you're curious and as long as you are willing to put yourself in situations which are uneasy for you, such as maybe you're not a people person, but you do have to meet clients and you do have to negotiate with investors, so that's difficult. But if you do these things, you don't necessarily need a degree. But a degree, sometimes, in order to get it, you will put yourself into these kind of situations anyway. So it helps you. It's a sort of a prop, let's say. But if you ask if you can do without it and build a successful startup, absolutely, yes, it is possible.
Yeah, but, and it's not even... But also, there are many countries where you have to spend an arm and a huge amount of money and end up with a huge debt for university.
But looking back on my life, I think I was, for a couple of years, I was pretty lost in a way. I mean, no, I was doing stuff, I thought. But I wrongfully pursued an academic career, actually, after I graduated. And I wish there was somebody that said back then, No, I mean, your soul is with startups and it's with entrepreneurship, and you want to build stuff.
You know, sometimes I think so that things that I did were not right, I had to do them to see that they are not right.
Yeah.
So I think that this is the same for your career. Now you have no regrets. You have no what would have happened if I did that. So I think it's good that you tried it. I mean,
Well,
it's also a way to have no regrets. Saying that this way also, it's a way of saying, well,
yeah, you have to do it in order to realize that you actually you don't like it. So
I think the song was Regrets. I have a few, right?
You also mentioned that part of the journey, you've been through a few accelerator programs, and also you mentioned a few mentors. Yeah, that's a lot already too.
Yeah.
But it's good experience, right? So what kind of advice, or what is the most impactful advice you received apart from these specific mentors that you mentioned earlier? Is it something that you really learned from other people?
I can start, I think, about it. So we realized that money has three dimensions, not only one. So people, when they think about money, they think about the amount. This is actually one third of what money means. There's also the time, where you have to have it now, not 2 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important and usually not thought about is that if they are smart or not smart money. Because you can have money from investors that worked in real estate and you want to do a fashion business, those are not good money. You want money from people that are in your domain, that can open doors for you and that motivates them to open doors for you. So one of the reasons we choose to do our business here and not in Eastern Europe was that here money are smarter, because they come from people that have experience with businesses, with educational companies, and with entrepreneurs. We didn't want money from self-made, who knows how, millionaires or billionaires in Eastern Europe. This last aspect of money was so important when we chose our first accelerator, because actually what we had to decide was, should we take 1 million from somebody that doesn't know anything about what we do, or
25,000
from somebody that helps us,
yeah,
and for the same amount of shares, I think, or similar. And we chose to get a fraction of the money, but which also brought us some people that we still work with today. And
there's also something about mentors, I think. They're sought after, right? Because they bring experience and intelligence and whatever. But they're also, they can be time wasters for you. And as a first-time founder, you don't really know how to navigate this world.
Mm.
And I think there is one thing which I did not expect, but this is... If that mentor really wants to mentorship you and to be with you along the way and help you, they will not ask or expect compensation. So asking compensation from the very beginning as a mentor, that's a very good sign that this is a bad situation. So run away as fast as you can. They will waste your time and money, and you will waste shares with them. Never do that. We haven't done it, so we do not talk.
We saw others.
And also the reverse of that is when you find somebody that is close to and you think would complement very well your company, drag them as close as possible to your company. We were actually very, very happy that one of our investors this wanted, and we really wanted that as well, to be part of the team. So that's a bit unheard of. So his name is Brian Daly, and he was criticizing us quite a lot,
mm-hmm.
but in a very good way,
yeah.
an annoying way initially, but very good way after we went over the ego part. And then then he started adding value to the company in ways in which we did not foresee, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is useful. That is fantastic. That's the kind of thing that you want to compensate and keep as close as possible.
Sorry.
But stay away from toxic mentors.
Yeah.
They can be...
And also from our side, entrepreneurial side, when you go to mentors or advisors, don't ask them to sign an NDA. That's a very bad thing. I mean, I saw people like, oh yes, I want some advice from you. Okay, sure. Sign this NDA.
But it's like VCs, they can't legally sign an NDA because they are seeing so many startups anyway. You can't just...
Because it's unenforceable. There's no way. Nobody won because of an NDA. Yeah. This is, it's silly. It's, but we see very young entrepreneurs. I mean, this is the thing that you should learn in the first month of being an entrepreneur. Yeah. Don't get anybody to sign an NDA. It's going to be awful. Like,
I'm going to tell you, but I have to kill you afterwards.
That's not how it doesn't
work.
I had such a great time, and before we wrap up, is there anything I haven't asked you and you wanted to talk about before we start wrapping up, or anything you wish me to ask you before?
Well,
if it's a no, that's completely okay. I mean, if we covered all the interesting things,
From my point of view, let's do it.
Yeah,
you want to send a message to the world, you know?
we want to send the message that we answer questions, so maybe we can take the last question if there is any.
Yeah, if anyone has any question, that's the moment. That's the last few minutes we have.
5, 4, 3,
yeah.
2.
Maybe we have credits and we have to do like in the news. We wrap up the prompter.
Is there any social media where you're super active, or anywhere people can find you and get more information about Hypersay?
Yes, you can find, obviously, first of all, is the website where we put all the effort, and we are quite happy with how it's going on.
So, hypersay.com.
Hypersay.com, that's it, simple, sweet. And then it's the Twitter, where we tend to communicate a little bit more than on other platforms. But we also obviously have LinkedIn, so depending on what you want to, but if you want to talk to us, there's a chat box on our button on our website.
Yes.
We are the ones on the other end of that.
Test it in 5 minutes.
And
see how quickly
and
we answer.
Then you can ask stuff from us. We can help you with whatever ideas that we have, or you want to test something. So we're quite open about it.
Huge thanks to Paul and Christian for joining me on the stream today. And thanks to all of you for listening to Entrepreneurs Playing Games podcast edition. You can find me on Twitter at AmandineFlux or at EntrepreneursPG, and be sure to check out and subscribe to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/AmandineFlux for the full video version of our discussion, all previous interviews, and much more. Also, if you want to join the live stream and ask your own questions to our next guest, Entrepreneurs Playing Games is taking place every 2 weeks on Saturday morning, so keep an eye on our social media, and I hope to see you there very soon.